From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
I'm asking international support on helicopters, cargo helicopters, to be able to transport goods to remote areas, inaccessible areas.
40,000 people are feared to have died in a massive earthquake in Pakistan and India. Aid is yet to reach many areas in what's believed to be the worst natural disaster in the country's history. We'll go to Lahore to get a report, then we take a look at the plight of American Indians living along the southeast coast of Louisiana weeks after Hurricane Katrina hit. Tribal leaders say they've been overlooked by the media, relief organizations, and the federal government.
Our tribal members have been greatly affected by Hurricane Katrina and Hurricane Rita, and it's very important for us to rebuild our communities. And to do that, we know that we cannot depend on our federal government. It has been our brothers and sisters in Indian country that has come to our aid and help us in this rebuilding process.
And today is known as Columbus Day. We'll take a look at why some people are not commemorating the arrival of Christopher Columbus to the so-called New World.
It's one of our 9 federal holidays, and I don't feel that my tax dollar should go towards sponsoring a symbol of racism and genocide in this country.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. At least 20,000 people have died in Pakistan and India in a massive earthquake, hardest hit around in the area, the Pakistani Kashmir capital of Muzaffarabad. It is believed to be the worst natural disaster in Pakistan's history. The official death toll stands at about 20,000, but officials fear the final number could exceed 40,000. Entire towns have been destroyed. Roads remain blocked. Schools and hospitals have been leveled. Thousands of children are believed to have died after their schools collapsed. A military spokesperson said, quote, "It's a whole generation that's been lost in the worst affected areas." The Pakistani president, Pervez Musharraf, made a plea for international help.
And because the roads are blocked, the problem is of transportation. And since a C-130 cannot land, we are totally bank on helicopter support. So there is a limitation of helicopters. I am asking international support on helicopters, cargo helicopters, to be able to transport goods to remote areas, inaccessible areas.
Agence France-Presse reports survivors are facing an array of problems: freezing overnight temperatures, rain, landslides, scarce food, little shelter, no communications networks, and almost non-existent health care. This is British rescue worker Claire Hanshaw.
At the moment, we're actually searching for a young girl. We've heard her, and we're trying to locate her at the moment, which is what the work that you can see going on up there is all about. But we're working with a local team here to try and find her.
The earthquake's epicenter was close to the dividing line between the Indian and Pakistani-controlled zones of Kashmir. We'll go to Pakistan for a report in a few minutes. Meanwhile, in Central America, at least 760 people have died in a series of mudslides and floods caused by Hurricane Stan. But the death toll is expected to soar. In Guatemala, about 1,400 people are feared to have been buried alive after mudslides overran 2 Mayan villages. Guatemalan officials said they would have to abandon these communities and declare them mass graveyards. Widespread damage has also been reported from the storm in El Salvador, Mexico, Nicaragua, Honduras, and Costa Rica. Officials say nearly 4 million Guatemalans and Mexicans have lost homes or livelihoods and will need aid. On Capitol Hill, House Democrats began chanting shame, shame, shame on Friday after the Republican leadership pushed through a bill to make it easier for oil companies to build new domestic refineries. The bill passed 212 to 210, but only because the House leadership extended the vote by 40 minutes, during which time 2 Republicans switched their vote. The legislation will streamline government permits for refineries, open federal lands for future refinery construction, weaken environmental protections, and offer subsidies to build refineries, even though oil companies are making record profits. Congressmember Ed Markey of Massachusetts called the legislation the, quote, "leave no oil man behind" bill. The bill would also limit the power of community or citizen groups, because if they file a lawsuit to challenge the location of a refinery, they'll be required to pay an oil company's legal costs, whether they win or lose the lawsuit. The New York Times reports during the extra 40 minutes of voting, House Speaker Dennis Hastert, Majority Whip Roy Blunt, and former Majority Leader Tom DeLay all pressured other Republicans to change their votes. After the Republicans extended the vote, Democrat Henry Waxman asked from the floor, quote, "Doesn't this make the House a banana republic?" Then House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi took the floor.
Mr. Speaker, my parliamentary inquiry, is it not bringing dishonor to the House of Representatives for this body to act in the shameful way that it is? This is not part of the culture of corruption of the Republican Party to dishonor the wishes of the American people.
Does the gentlelady have a parliamentary
inquiry? I have a parliamentary inquiry.
That was House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi. In New Orleans, three city police officers are facing charges in connection with the beating of a 64-year-old African-American man and the assault on an Associated Press television producer. On Saturday night, the police began hitting the man accused of public intoxication outside a French Quarter bar. The man, 64-year-old Robert Davis, was hit at least four times in the head and was dragged to the ground when another officer kneed him in the back. The incident was caught on tape by a crew from the Associated Press. Once the police realized they were being videotaped, they ordered the AP to stop filming. When the AP producer held up his press credentials, an officer grabbed him, leaned him backward over a car, jabbed him in the stomach, and started screaming at him to leave the scene. Meanwhile, on Friday, state authorities in Louisiana announced they were investigating allegations that during Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans police broke into a car dealership and made off with nearly 200 cars, including 41 new Cadillacs. A number of environmental groups and activists are criticizing the Nobel Peace Prize Committee for awarding this year's prize to the International Atomic Energy Agency and its chief, Mohamed El Baradei. The French group Sortir du Nucléaire, Get Out of Nuclear, criticized the IAEA for, quote, promoting civilian nuclear plants. British commentator George Monbiot said the prize to the IAEA and its boss are a, quote, reward for failure in an age of rampant proliferation. Greenpeace also criticized the selection. This is Jan van de Put of Greenpeace International.
We're really shocked because the Atomic Agency has been responsible for over 50 years to promote the spread of nuclear technology. And this is the cause of the spread of nuclear weapons. Every country with a nuclear reactor has enough plutonium every year to produce about 30 nuclear weapons. So there is a direct link between nuclear power and nuclear bombs.
That was Jan van de Put of Greenpeace International. A hunger strike at the U.S.-run prison camp at Guantanamo Bay has entered its third month. At least 22 detainees have been hospitalized and are being force-fed through nasal tubes and IVs. The number of detainees taking part in the hunger strike is in dispute. The Center for Constitutional Rights estimates 210 prisoners are on hunger strike. The U.S. military says as many as 130 took part in the strike, but that only 26 are still refusing to eat. In Los Angeles, thousands gathered Saturday for a silent peace march led by Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, who was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize in 1967 by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Among those in attendance was Cindy Sheehan, who lost her son in Iraq on April 4th, 2004. Meanwhile, here in New York, protests are scheduled at today's Columbus Day parade against the invitation of an Italian cabinet minister who once fought for Benito Mussolini. The official Mirko Tremaglia is one of the honored guests at today's parade, along with Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Tremaglia is a member of the right-wing National Alliance Party and is a former member of the pro-fascist Italian social movement. Last year, he was strongly condemned by gay rights groups when he publicly said, quote, "Poor Europe, the faggots are in the majority." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Rescuers struggled to reach remote mountainous areas 2 days after Pakistan's worst-ever earthquake wiped out entire villages, buried roads in rubble, and knocked out electricity and water supplies. The official death toll stands at 20,000, but is widely expected to rise, with some estimates putting the dead at double that. Aid agencies are saying more than 120,000 people are in urgent need of shelter, and up to 4 million could be left homeless. The 7.6 magnitude earthquake struck close to Muzaffarabad in Pakistan-administered Kashmir on Saturday morning. The tremor was felt as far away as Kabul and Delhi, but the main areas affected have been Kashmir and Pakistan's northwest frontier province. Many towns appear to have been flattened, and government aid has yet to arrive. Most of Muzaffarabad has been destroyed or severely damaged. The city's cricket stadium is being used to house the homeless and tend to survivors. The rescue effort has been slowed by landslides, which have wiped out roads and bridges, and a lack of helicopters to ferry in vital heavy lifting equipment. Anger started to build as help failed to arrive. In many places, people reportedly dug with their bare hands in an attempt to reach friends and relatives trapped in the rubble. Many of the earthquake's victims are school children who've just begun classes when school buildings collapsed on top of them. Pakistan's military spokesperson, Major General Shaukat, told Agence France-Presse, quote, "It's a whole generation that's been lost in the worst affected areas." In the capital of Islamabad, as many as 150 students are still trapped in the wreckage of a school, but with no heavy equipment, rescuers have all but given up the search. In the town of Balakot, as many as 250 students are thought to still be trapped. Meanwhile, Pakistan's President Pervez Musharraf appealed for international help and asked for tents, blankets, transport helicopters, and medicine. United States has offered 8 military helicopters and said it's contributing $50 million in aid. Many other countries across the world have offered financial help and practical support. We go now to Pakistan to speak with Moeen Chima, a professor of law and policy at Lahore University of Management Sciences. He's also head of the Adventure Society, an outdoor group that's traveled extensively throughout the region, joining us on the line from Lahore. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
It's good to have you with us. Hi. Can you tell us what you understand is the extent of this catastrophe?
Well, as you point out in your report, it is estimated to be enormous. They've recently opened up the roads to Muzaffarabad, and I've just heard that they've opened up the road to Balakot. But that just gives that this is the tip of the iceberg, because what has happened in the cities is it's becoming visible, but nobody has any idea what has happened in the more remote villages. Even in the best of times, these are areas that we've been trekking through. There are very few jeep tracks. These are fairly inaccessible areas, and whole villages have been apparently been wiped out because of landslides and mudslides. So it will be a few days, and before the true extent of the disaster is found out.
We're also joined on the line from Lahore by Tarak Ali. We usually speak to him in London, but he's traveled back to the place where he was born, Pakistan. Can you tell us what you have learned so far, Tarak?
Well, I agree with what Munir has just said. It's one of the most horrendous natural disasters to have hit this country. And Amy, people are really angry that the government obviously is doing its best. One can't say it isn't, but its best is not good enough. And you have these great military machines, both here and in neighboring Afghanistan, ready to make war drop bombs whenever they have to, with a vast fleet of helicopters. What's shocking is that people couldn't be rescued from villages and remote places, or Muzaffarabad and Balakot as well, where the roads were cut off and the only way to reach them was by helicopter. And the country's president, General Musharraf, was saying, "We don't have enough helicopters," but in neighboring Afghanistan, there's a whole fleet of bloody helicopters which could have been diverted to help people in need rather than being used for purposes of war. And so it's just that when there's an emergency, as we saw in New Orleans, people are, military forces good at repressing things are pretty useless when it comes to helping people.
We're talking to Tariq Ali, who has written the book Bush in Babylon and the Clash of Fundamentalisms, Moeen Cheema, professor of law and policy at Lahore University of Management Sciences. Professor Cheema, I understand you just had a major meeting of people at the university to figure out what to do. What are the plans? How can you help? And how far are you from ground zero?
Actually, we're based in the city of Lahore, so we're quite far, distance-wise from where the disaster has struck. We just had a major meeting at the university in order to coordinate some of the relief effort that has begun here. What has happened in Pakistan? I mean, it's heartening to see that there's been major outpouring of sympathy, and people are wanting to contribute whichever way they can. Some of our students were actually wanting to go up, to Balakot and that side to actually, volunteer with the rescue effort. But what we've, what we've come to realize, and what has come through in some of the discussions, is that, in many other countries, what happens is after a major disaster, there's an immediate relief effort. People donate money, they donate whatever goods and are needed. But then over the long term, as soon as the disaster fades into the memory, which is very likely to happen in this area, because politically these are not very important areas. These are remote areas. And, civil society networks and information networks, news networks aren't very well developed, especially because of, the heavy military presence, especially in Azad Kashmir. So what is likely to happen, we're afraid, is that, in a little while, people will forget about it. And when it comes to the reconstruction phase, a lot of money will be, pilfered. There will be corruption. And we're trying to put in place some long-term assistance projects, as well as to the immediate relief effort, so that we could monitor some of the relief effort. We could monitor some of the reconstruction effort that takes place after a while. Mm.
Tariq Ali, can you talk about the significance of the area that has been so hard hit and what is happening between the Indian and the Pakistani government? Certainly a flashpoint in relations between Pakistan and India, this Pakistan-administered area of Kashmir.
Well, no, this is a flashpoint region, but both countries have been collaborating and trying to help each other, which is at least one small mercy in this horrible situation. I mean, there's also a report which has been published today that about 400 Pakistani soldiers who were sitting in trenches on the Pakistani side of Kashmir in readiness for any emergency with India, i.e. in war readiness, when the earthquake came, there was a big landslide and 400 soldiers just died. I mean, nothing could be done to help them. A total waste of life, both of the ordinary soldiery and of people. Now, Moeen is absolutely right, and I would sort of re-emphasize that there is no real infrastructure in place, as far as the official government is concerned, to make sure that the money coming in is used for the purposes for which it is being sent. And ordinary people are fearful that lots of money that comes in will be go into the pockets of bureaucrats or people administering the funds and will never reach those who it is meant to reach. But the region itself, both the Northwest Frontier, of course, is a region where there's a lot of poverty, especially in the villages. It's quite a strategically important region, given now the U.S. presence in Afghanistan. And the Kashmir region is important militarily because of the conflict with India. Mercifully, that has been neutered now, and there's been lots of negotiations and talks going on for several months. But what it does prove is that the army was there in force but could not do anything when it came to helping people. It is not a force which is trained, as we saw even in New Orleans when the big disaster hit the United States. Lots of soldiers who went were good at pointing guns, were not good at helping the poor people in that part of the world. And the same we are now witnessing here. It's not that the ordinary soldiers don't want to help. There is no real leadership coming from above. And the other point which has to be made, Amy, that in Islam, Islamabad, two giant towers, the Merkaba towers, probably modeled on the Twin Towers so that every wretched country in the third world can have its own equivalent, have been hit and people are still trapped in there. And in a country like Pakistan, especially in earthquake zones, to build these giant skyscrapers just in order to mimic the United States is just completely crazy, and I wish to God they'd stop doing it.
We're talking to Tariq Ali and Moin Chima. They are both in Lahore. Professor Chima, this issue of the area being this flashpoint, we have heard reports of Indian soldiers also helping in the area. Do you think this could change the politics of the region?
Well, you know, I've heard comments to the effect that this could be, quote-unquote, an opportunity for both countries to come together, you know, in the face of this disaster. But honestly, my personal assessment is that it's not likely to happen. This is a very highly militarized area. Historically, even though Pakistan has made fairly tall claims about protecting and furthering the rights of self-determination of the Kashmiris, but ever since Kashmir has been, Azad Kashmir as we call it, independent Kashmir has been part of Pakistan, very little has been done to develop the area. Very little has been done to improve the quality of the citizens' lives. So what is happening even now is, all the information that you're getting is from the military. You're not getting any information from the civil society sources. And I think, there will be a lot of talk, but in terms of actual support, the joint operations of any sort, I think that that's not likely to happen.
And Tariq Ali, the northwest frontier province, the area where Osama bin Laden has reputed to be, what is the significance of this in this natural catastrophe, the worst in Pakistan's history?
With the northwest frontier province, I was meant to be going to Peshawar this week to give a public lecture, but which has now been cancelled because of this, and I'm still going to try and get as close as I can. But the parts of the province have been hit. Balakot is a city which everyone is talking about and discussing. And this city, according to reports, has been virtually completely destroyed. It's a city I used to know well in the old days. It's an important route to the mountains. This is sad. Peshawar itself has not been a hit. There have been tremors there. Islamabad is the city which has been hurt the most. And where they say the Al-Qaeda network is, I say they say because no one knows, in the Waziristan region of the northwest frontier and the tribal districts, I'm told that the tremors there have been very slight indeed. So I don't think that that will be affected. And Kabul, of course, has not been affected at all. So I don't think, Amy, that this is going to affect anything on that front. I mean, there are Pakistani troops in action in Waziristan fighting there against supposed Al-Qaeda units, and a number of Pakistani soldiers have been killed in these clashes. Whether this is just to show the United States that the army is active or whether there's really someone there is an open question. Nobody knows.
Finally, the issue of foreign aid. The U.S. has offered $50 million. How does that compare to the U.S. military aid that goes to Pakistan?
Well, it's just nothing. It's completely peanuts compared to the military aid that comes to this country. And this is always the case. The time and time again we've seen this when there are floods, when there are natural disasters, the amount of money made available for humanitarian relief is piffling compared to the billions which are poured in to arm armies all over the world. And I think that this is being talked about now by ordinary people, saying, where does the money go? Even the limited money which comes, where does it go? And why can't more money be sent? And, I really hope, because what we need, everyone knows what we need now is a massive presence of surgeons and doctors as well. I don't think the United States is capable of supplying those, and I hope the Cubans, who have a very vast supply of medical of doctors and medical aid, will get into the act. They haven't so far. I don't think they have any formal relations with Pakistan, but really help is needed for the poor of this country. The rich always are barely unaffected, but even when they are, they're the ones, like in New Orleans, who manage to survive and get away. It's the poor who suffer, and it's the poor who need the help of the world, and they need help not just with food and blankets, but we also need doctors here, and we need them urgently.
If I may just add something.
Professor Chima, last words.
Newspapers heard that immediately after the disaster, the U.S. offered $100,000 in emergency aid. And that has, you know, caused a lot of, that has been the subject of, you know, ridicule in the national press, especially the opposition religious parties have made a big deal out of it. And even those eight Chinook helicopters that have been, offered to Pakistan are fairly late in the coming because, as you know, after a disaster like an earthquake, it's the first 48 hours that are critical. And a lot of people, you know, that has caused a lot of concern in Pakistan regarding the sort of effort that we've received from the, help that we've received from the U.S.
It's interesting to see this in relation to compare it to the tsunami when the U.S. had also offered, just a very small amount of aid afterwards. And then after public outcry, increased the amount. Scott McClellan, the White House press secretary, just saying the 50 million number after the first 100,000 offer. I want to thank you both for being. Yes, Tarek, very quickly.
Okay, Amy. Yeah.
I want to thank you both for being with us. Tarek Ali, Bush in Babylon, speaking to us from Lahore, Pakistan, as is Moeen Chima, professor of law and policy at Lahore University of Management Sciences. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back to this country, to Louisiana, to the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina. And on this day that some call Columbus Day, others call Indigenous Peoples Day, we'll speak with Native leaders about the state of Native America and Louisiana. Stay with us. Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman as we broadcast on over 375 stations around the country, on Pacifica NPR and low-power FM stations, as well as on public access TV and PBS stations. We're also broadcasting on both satellite TV networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and also on DirecTV Channel 375. And we're podcasting at democracynow.org. And for the images of the disaster from New Orleans to the Pakistan-Indian border, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. Though there's been a lot of attention, the devastation brought by Hurricane Katrina now, some victims have been overlooked. An estimated 4,500 American Indians living along the southeast Louisiana coast lost everything to Hurricane Katrina, according to state officials as well as tribal leaders. Hurricane Rita, which hit a month after Katrina, dealt another blow to the tribes. Officials estimate between 5,000 and 6,000 American Indians lost their homes or possessions, and that's storm. The Louisiana tribes most affected by the back-to-back hurricanes are the United Houma Nation, the Pointe-Chene tribe, the Isle de Jean-Charles Indian Band of Biloxi Chitimacha, the Grand Kailu Dulac Band, and the Biloxi Chitimacha Confederation of Muscogees. Tribal leaders have complained they're being overlooked by the media, by relief organizations, and by the federal government. Houma Nation Chief Brenda Darda Robichaud said in an article published in the Houma Nation newspaper last week, "We are an Indian tribe here that is falling through the cracks. Nobody has made contact with us except the native media. Everything we're doing has been a grassroots effort and has taken weeks to get this far with the help of many volunteers and private donations. We're basically doing it on our own," she wrote. The problem is made worse for the Houma Nation and some of the smaller tribes because they lack federal recognition from the government and the accompanying money that comes with such official acknowledgement. We're joined on the phone now by Brenda Darda Robichaud, the principal chief of the United Houma Nation. We're also joined by Charles Verdin, the chair of the Pointe-Chene Indian Tribe. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Let's begin with Brenda Darda Robichaud. Can you describe where in Louisiana the tribe is and what has happened?
I'll begin by giving a brief history. We were once in the area of Baton Rouge. That's our state capital. Baton Rouge stands for a red stick, which was a boundary marker between us and a neighboring tribe. We migrated south, and we're once in the area of New Orleans. If you were to visit Louis Armstrong Park, you would see a commemorative plaque that states it was our ceremonial grounds and our hunting grounds, and we played the traditional game of stick ball there. We continue to migrate south, and our largest population lives along the bayous of Terrebonne Parish and Plaquemines Parish, all along the eastern coast. In the mid-30s and 40s, there were no educational opportunities for our children, so some tribal members moved back to the New Orleans area because they could attend school there. And it's those isolated settlements and communities that was destroyed with Hurricane Katrina. And then we forward a few weeks, and Hurricane Rita came, and the people who live along the bayous of southeast Louisiana were devastated by Hurricane Rita. If you know anything about storms, Rita came to us and was on our eastern side, which brings a tremendous amount of flooding, and that's what happened to our bayou communities.
Can you talk about right now the kind of aid that you're getting?
The aid we have gotten has been from people who are upset with the administration, for people who feel that they did not act quickly enough and properly, and people who want to come out and make a difference. And we are humbled and blessed that they have come to our rescue. They have been providing us with much-needed services to be able to recover from the storm. And it's been Indian tribes and Indian organizations throughout the United States that has come to our aid as well.
Can you describe what federal recognition has to do with it, or not having federal recognition that you've been fighting for several decades?
Right. We've been in the federal recognition process now for 21 years, and we still have not received what's called the final determination from the federal government. And that has hindered our relief efforts as well because we're not qualifying for certain money, certain funding, certain relief aid that would be out there if we were a federally recognized tribe. And so we're having to do this on our own. And as I said earlier, we're blessed that Indian tribes and Indian communities and people from throughout the United States have come to help us in our relief efforts. If you were to look at my yard right now, there's probably about 20 tents that are set up, people from all over the United States who are coming in and helping us to provide services, everything from outreach, bringing much-needed food and cleaning supplies and medical needs to our Indian communities, as well as a group of construction workers who's trying to do roof repair and just cleaning, just basic cleaning. With our flooding came a lot of sludge and mud that went into the homes, and it really takes a major effort to be able to clean all that out. And so they're in there lending a hand, helping some of our tribal elders clean their homes as well. We had a group with the Eagles organization who came down and provided much-needed medical assistance. They were administering tetanus shots as well as flu shots. and providing just basic general first aid and medical needs. Because when our tribal members are in the middle of all of this trying to clean and recover, they're really not taking care of themselves. They're not addressing their medical needs. They're not taking their medications. They're not eating properly. And so we've been able to do outreach and make sure that they are getting the proper nourishment and that they are receiving medical attention.
Hmm. We're also joined by Charles Verdon, chair of the Point de Chien Indian Tribe. Did I pronounce that right?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you talk about where your tribe is and how it has been affected by Hurricanes Katrina and Rita?
We're located about 60 miles southwest of New Orleans, and we're right on the coast, about 15 miles from the Barrier Islands, from the Gulf of Mexico. And we're a small community. We've been there since earliest time, you know. We're basically from the Chetamaches, and then we have other Indian tribes that's come over, you know, over history and to live with us as the Indians were being moved around from one end to the other. But we're just a small fishing community. Most of our tribe who lives in our community are all fishermen, either from shrimping, crabbing, and oystering, while others work for the oil field. But our community was covered with water. We had anywhere from 8 to 9 foot of water. And some of the homes that were high on piling that were pulled up before, you know, we're doing okay. But those who were not able to pick their homes up, you know, we have about 40 homes that were taken over from water.
What presence is there of FEMA, of the federal government, in your area?
FEMA has visited a couple of families, and a couple of families have received some help, but most of our members have received nothing and have not even seen FEMA.
What do people understand they have to do to get help?
It's just a long process with paperwork, and so a lot of our members are older members, do not have no education. So if somebody comes there and gives some forms, you know, they don't know what to do with it. So we're trying to get people out there to help them fill out these forms, and it just takes some time.
Brenda Darda-Rabichaud, what about you in terms of the presence of FEMA? When we were down in New Orleans, Baton Rouge area, right after Katrina, as we drove between the two cities, there was always that exit for Houma, and we understood that there was a mass evacuation site or infirmary there of about 1,000 people who were in Houma. How does that relate to the Houma Nation?
We did have quite a few of our tribal members that did have to evacuate to one of the local shelters. And right after Hurricane Rita hit, I was able to go down and visit the bayou. I wanted to see firsthand the devastation that our tribal members would be facing. And when I got to visit, you could not even see the line in the highway. So I went over to the shelter later that afternoon after our site visit and visited with about 35 families who were in one of the local shelters and told them that we were there to help them to try to provide relief effort by way of clothing that had been donated to us by Walmart, as well as some food supplies, because a lot of them left with just a couple of changes of clothing, never imagining that they would lose everything in their homes. And so in visiting with them, I invited them to come to our relief center the following day, which they did. But while they were there, they received a call from the shelter that stated that they had to get out. It was 11:30 in the morning, and they had to be out by noon because, as the lady put it, they were being thrown out. And I can't tell you the sadness that overtook the shelter and just tears from parents and children asking their mothers, but where are we going to go? Because they knew that they could not go back into their homes. They were still flooded. And at the same time, they had to leave that shelter. And what they ended up doing was moving them to the larger shelter that still had people from the New Orleans area that had been evacuated there. But some of them chose to go back into their homes, even though there were no condition for them to return to. They chose to go back into their homes. And so we do have some tribal members who are living 30, 20 people, family members in one home, maybe three bedrooms, one bath. And so we are just trying to take each other in, community to community, friend to family, just trying to recover from this. But we do have some of our tribal members that are still in shelters. And when we contact FEMA and tell them about some of the struggles we're facing, I have a family, for instance, in the New Orleans area, and it's a lady raising her grandchildren. And we visited the community in Lafitte. Her trailer, her home, had no floor to it. Her floor was an area rug that she had put down. She had Visqueen strapped to the top of her ceiling, and that's what she was living in. So we contacted FEMA and said, what does it take to get one of these mobile homes here? Because if a person like this does not qualify, then tell me who does. And we've really had problems getting FEMA's attention. And we're not asking for a lot, but if there's a need, then these needs should be addressed. And our tribal members do understand that they have got to fill out an application in order to be serviced. We understand that. But a lot of our tribal members have a very limited education. So what we were asking FEMA was to allow us to help them, to help our tribal members in this process, because they don't know enough, you know, they're not formally educated enough to understand the paperwork. So we would want to be there with them, because a lot of them speak only our native language of French, and they just cannot communicate well because of language barriers, because of cultural barriers, and so we would want to assist them in this paperwork process. And that has not happened as of yet. FEMA has not come to allow us to help them, help our tribal members.
Charles Verdon of Ponoshin Indian Tribe, what is the spirit of the people of your tribe right now?
We still have a lot of them that got their spirits up. A lot of them, you know, just they've been through this over here already. And, you know, we'll rebuild. Now you have some, you know, our elder people that's just tired. They're getting too old to do the cleanup job like this, and some of their spirits are down. And some of them talk about getting out, you know. But we're trying to get some kind of relief to help them rebuild higher. And when I talk to them about this, they were all for it. And some older members, again, are, they don't like the idea of going too high. I think, like, the home would have to be picked up about 10, 12 foot high, and it'd be hard for them to go up and down. And so we're trying to get some process to where we could fix them up. It'd be kind of hard. But with this, we have no help from FEMA. We're trying to do this with a local group and a couple of other Indian tribes who came in the area to help us.
To who came in to help? Which tribes?
We have a group from the Porch Creek out of Alabama, and with the Mennonites. They're have made no promise yet, but they're in the area, you know, looking and talking with people and see what kind of help they could give us. And I guess within the next month or so, we ought to know. But they did send some mattress down to our area, because we still had some people that were sleeping on the floors, and some of them were sleeping in their cars and, you know, staying by their home. That way they could do some cleaning up during the daytime and nighttime. It either smelled too bad or just plain too hot. So,
well, Charles Verdon, chair of the Pointeshen Indian Tribe, and Brenda Darda-Rabichaud of the United Homa Nation, principal chief. I want to ask you to stay with us. We're going to go to break. And we come back, I want to talk about the significance of this day, of what is recognized as Columbus Day, what others call Indigenous Peoples Day, and what this means to you. Please stay with us.
Until that day, although
Julian B., a native rapper from New Mexico. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Yes, today is known as Columbus Day, supposed to commemorate the arrival of Christopher Columbus to the so-called New World in 1492. But the holiday has long caused anger amongst people of color, especially Native Americans, who object to honoring a man who opened the door to European colonization, exploitation of Native peoples, and the slave trade. We're joined now by Roberto Macaro Barrero, who is president of the United Confederation of Taino People. Also on the line with us is Brenda Darda-Rabichaud, principal chief of the United Home and Nation, and Charles Verdin, chair of the Pontchartrain Indian Tribe, both from the Louisiana area. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Roberto.
Bomantum, Nito'u, Amy Goodman. Thank you, Sister Amy, for inviting me here today.
It is good to have you with us. What about this day, Columbus Day?
Well, I think today is just a blatant example of the continuation of the campaign of genocide against indigenous peoples throughout this hemisphere, and the propping up of racist propaganda, which I think is very significant in a country like the United States that is supposed to be championing human rights throughout the globe. But yet here we are celebrating a man who, as you stated, began the genocide of indigenous peoples, exploitation of resources in this hemisphere, and also was the first person to initiate the transatlantic slave trade in this hemisphere.
Explain that.
Well, he was the first one, Christopher Columbus, because of the outcry of some of the people in Spain against enslaving native peoples, indigenous peoples, particularly Taínos and other indigenous peoples around the Caribbean and South American area, that they substituted the bringing in of peoples from the African continent to take over the places of people or indigenous peoples working in mines in these areas, or to provide labor for sugarcane plantations, et cetera, et cetera. And it was Columbus that initiated this because this was already going on from the Portuguese people who were already going to the coast of Africa to enslave, capture and enslave people for those kind of purposes.
Can you talk about the origins of Indigenous Peoples Day?
Sure. Indigenous Peoples Day came as a result. It's not a federal holiday, recognized holiday, unlike Columbus Day is. But Indigenous Peoples Day came as a result of advocacy of Indigenous peoples on the international front. As you know, from 1992, there was a large outcry of Indigenous peoples protesting the planned quincentennial celebrations that they wanted to instituted in the United Nations system. Spain had championed this, that the discovery of America should be something that the whole world should be thankful for, etc. And this, of course, there was a tremendous outcry from indigenous peoples, not only in this hemisphere, but around the world, saying that this is just another example of racism against indigenous peoples, and our problems haven't gone away from that point in time till today. So there was talk about October 12th being designated as International Indigenous Peoples Day within the UN system. What happened was that the UN kind of backed off of that because they were afraid of too many countries opposing this. So they decided that they would settle for the day of August 9th, 1993, to be designated as the year, International Year of Indigenous Peoples. And then following that, they would follow up every August 9th would be the International Day of the World's Indigenous Peoples. But from that advocacy, there was a group of Native peoples, actually a Muscogee Creek woman, was petitioning the Berkeley Town City Council to substitute the celebrations of Columbus Day on the local level, on the municipal level, to Indigenous Peoples Day. And that's really where it started. So in 1992, the city of Berkeley designated October 12th as Indigenous Peoples Day instead of Columbus Day. And from there, many other peoples have followed suit, and now they're calling this day, indigenous peoples throughout the hemisphere, calling this day Indigenous Peoples Day.
One of the major sites where there is protest every year on this day is Denver.
Yes, that was actually the first state-sponsored celebration of Columbus Day in the United States, 1905. And so I think it's very significant that one of the largest demonstrations against the Columbus Day holiday and for the abolishment of the Columbus Day holiday is happening in Denver. And this has been going on. I mean, the protests have been growing every year. This weekend they had many educational activities, a march, et cetera, happening over there. And so, you know, we support them as well in what they're doing.
I wanted to ask Brenda Darda-Rabichaud on this day your thoughts with the Houma Nation in Louisiana.
I think it's still a sad situation because, let's face it, Columbus was a slave trader, an Indian killer, and he doesn't deserve parades and holidays, and this should not be a day of celebration. It should be a national day of mourning. And I actually work for Lafourche Parish School Board Indian Education, and I'm often asked to do presentations in the school systems. And I know when I was growing up, we were not taught the true story of Columbus. And so I always use that as an opportunity to give our perspective of Columbus and the truth about what he's done to indigenous people. And I'm happy to say that it finally is being addressed in the school system by some teachers who choose that the truth be told and that the true story be shared with young minds. And so it is something that finally the school system is addressing and that the true picture of Christopher Columbus is coming.
Charles Verdon of the Pontchartrain Indian Tribe in Louisiana.
Yeah, we never really celebrated Columbus. Our people never did celebrate it. It just come and gone just like another day.
Roberto Macaro Barrero, where were you born?
I was actually born right here in New York City. My parents came from the island of Boriquen, which we say in our Taino language is the indigenous name for the island of Puerto Rico. My family comes from a town called Guayanilla, which is a coastal town that extends into the hill lands, and that's where I learned about my native heritage from my grandfather and his brothers over there when I was very young, as my family brought me back to the island when I was just a little baby.
What about international solidarity on this issue? What is happening? What kind of organizing?
Well, I think besides this local initiatives and this national campaign to abolish Columbus Day, we're seeing an increase in international solidarity. I don't know if you're aware, but in 2002, President Chavez in Venezuela, there was a group of people who actually toppled the Columbus statue in the square, and they President Chavez proclaimed October 12th, Indigenous Peoples Resistance Day, instead of Columbus Day, acknowledging the genocide of Indigenous peoples and also the enslavement of African peoples. So this was his statement to support. And we see other protests and gatherings happening from down in Chile all the way up through Canada, and even as far as Hawaii, where they quote unquote the day over there of celebration, quote unquote, is Discoverer's Day, because they didn't have Columbus but Captain Cook. So it's same situation, even as far as over there. So there's a solidarity happening with all these people, connecting, letting folks know what's happening, because we don't really have coverage, as you can see. The system that's been ensued in this hemisphere for these past 500 years, Native peoples are still invisible. We have the situation of our dear relatives that were affected by Katrina and Rita, and still the mainstream media has not covered this. And I think this is true in the school systems. We see that we're still learning a mythical, chronological story about Columbus and his role in discovering America when he actually never even set foot in the United States. And we learn about
Explain
his...
Explain that.
Well, he actually landed in the Caribbean islands and only hit South America, the northern coast of South America, and off the coast of the Mexico in the Yucatan area. These were the only places that he actually visited. So it's interesting that while many Latin American countries are celebrating what they call La Dia de las Razas, or the Day of the Races, which is supposed to talk about the coming together of the Spanish and indigenous races, that the United States, a country where he never actually set foot in, is celebrating this as a federal holiday and one of the nine recognized federal holidays. So I just find that interesting, and especially considering the controversy and what he's you know, even in his own writings, he's admitted to. And again, if we look at the Convention of Against Genocide, we know what happened here in the Americas qualifies under that convention as genocide.
Brenda Darter-Rabichaud of the Houma Nation, after Katrina and working with your nation there, and then looking at this day, Columbus Day, are there politicians who have dared to take on this issue of Columbus Day, Christopher Columbus, quote, discovering the New World, or perhaps changing the name of this day?
No, not in our community, not at all. It's not even a thought in their mind. It's nothing that they're going to address or even consider.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. I want to thank Brenda Darter-Rabichaud, Principal Chief of the United Houma Nation, Charles Verdin, Chair of the Pointe-Chien Indian Tribe, and Roberto Macaro Barrero. If people want to find out more information, where on the web can they go?
Yeah, sure, they can visit the website of the United Confederation of Taino People, which is www.uctp.org. Or they can actually, to find out about people who want to change Columbus Day into a Native American Day, they can actually visit the website of United Native America. And that's just www.unitednativeamerica.org.
And we will link to it at democracynow.org. I want to thank you all for being with us. And finally, I'd like to take this moment to thank everyone who wrote in this past week to express sympathy on the loss of my grandmother, Sonia Bach. She died on October 5th, 2005, at the age of 108. Yes, she was indomitable, a woman of three centuries. She was born in 1897 in Rovno, Poland, which changed back and forth between Poland and Russia. She lived through Tsarist Russia, the Bolshevik Revolution, the Holocaust, though many in her family did not. Two of her brothers and their whole families perished. I remember my mother telling me about the summer she was at the bungalow colony with her sister and her parents, and the wail that went up in this small colony of people when my mother learned, when her grandmother got a letter telling her about the fate of her family. My grandmother came to America by boat in 1929 at the height of the Depression with my grandfather, an Orthodox rabbi. In 1930, she gave birth to my mother in Harlem here in New York. Then my grandmother and grandfather moved to Crown Heights, where they lived much of their life, where my mother and her sister grew up. In the 1950s, my grandmother contracted cerebral meningitis and was sent to a sanatorium, like many, in the Catskills. She lived there for 2 years, not expected to survive. But she did, by, in her inimitable way, organizing and cutting everyone's hair. That was her small stab at independence. She was an unusual mix of old-fashioned and very modern in her views of women. She always told us, you have to be independent. She said, when your husband comes home, meet him with a hug and supper, then give him the newspaper, but read it first because you want to discuss it with him. She said, communication is everything. She was the eternal student. She spoke a number of languages, Russian, Yiddish, Hebrew, English, was always taking conversation classes in French. She stood about 4 feet 10 inches tall. She was a pint-sized fireball, a life force, my heart. I'd like to end by sharing a poem that I also read when my dear father died. I don't know who wrote it. If someone does, you can write in. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am the diamond glints on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you awaken in the morning's hush, I am the swift, uplifting rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I am the soft star that shines at night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not there. I did not die. want to thank everyone at Democracy Now! Who has been here for our family. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.